May it please the court. My name is Steve Garner, and I'm here on behalf of Emily Williams. The court's aware of the facts, and I don't have enough time where I want to spend time on the facts, but I want to address the issues that we have raised on appeal. There's two issues. One, the wrongful removal of post-judgment interest after the court lacked jurisdiction, and the other is the wrongful application of 538.220, the future payments statute. The post-judgment interest issue is the easiest issue to address. What happened in this case was there were actually two judgments that were entered. The first was entered on March the 8th, and when we sent it in, we had distributed it to defense counsel, told them we hadn't heard a response. They responded. The court knocked down that judgment. Then we had a 538.220 hearing, and the court entered another judgment on March 20th, wherein he assessed future payments, but he specifically allowed post-judgment interest. Now, this chart right here, I get confused with dates, so I always put things in a chronological order so that I can keep it straight. So what happens is, at the time that Mercy filed its authorized post-trial motions, it did not ask the court to take out post-judgment interest. It didn't ask for that. So under Rule 85.01, once 30 days from the entry of the second judgment, which we could argue the first, but we're saying the second judgment, 30 days after that, then the court's jurisdiction is limited to what is presented in the properly filed post-trial motions. So in this particular case, the circuit court lost the authority to remove post-judgment interest April the 19th of 2017. Now,
defense argues that they could, the court still had the power to correct plain error because the court still had jurisdiction over the case because these after-trial motions had been filed, and under Rule 7808, I think, the court is allowed to correct plain error.
The court's recent decision, this court's recent decision in State XRL Josh Holly, Attorney General Josh Holly versus Pilot, indicates that argument to be wrong. In that case, which came out on the 21st, the court said the court's jurisdiction, general jurisdiction, that exists for the first 30 days, where they can change a judgment at their own volition, make corrections at their own volition, they have that for 30 days under 75.01. Once a post-trial motion is filed under Rule 85.01, the court's jurisdiction is limited to that raised in the authorized post-trial motions. And so the court would indicate, I would suggest that, no, you can't change that on plain error because you don't have jurisdiction. Your jurisdiction is limited solely to the issues they raised. They did not raise the issue of post-judgment interest, and so the time ran.
Now, the court still has jurisdiction, but didn't have the authority to grant that relief, is what you're
saying. Yes, it had limited jurisdiction without the authority to grant that relief. It's probably the better way to put it. Now, they say that this would be unfair to them, but there have been two cases that have been ruled where post-judgment interest was added by a court at a time after the court retained authority to do that. I've cited them in our brief. One is the SDMVL case, in which case the defense lawyer and the plaintiff's lawyer both agreed that there should be post-judgment interest. And the court changed the order, but the court didn't have jurisdiction, so on appeal that was taken away. The other is I believe it's McNamara case that we cited. Again, the court went in and added post-judgment interest after it had, and it was entitled in both cases, there was no dispute about that, after it had lost the power to do so. And in that case, the post-judgment interest, the change of the judgment, was found to be without effect. They took that away. So in this case, the rules are working to allow post-judgment interest. In those cases, the rules worked to take it away. Now, the second issue we have is on the future periodic payments. The court entered two orders. In the first order, it assessed $3 million to future periodic payments. In the second, it ordered $11 million. Now, the easiest analysis, I think, is that applying Watts, as it is written, would indicate that the court abused its discretion in putting $11 million in future payments. And the reason why, Watts allowed, as I read Watts, the future payments provision to escape constitutional axing, to put it differently, only because the court retains what is considered equitable power to give in whole or in part the future medical order. What the court recognized in that case is exactly what we have here. The two statutes, 538.215 and 538.220, cannot exist in harmony when the interest rate in 538.220 is substantially less than the rate used to discount to present value. So in a trial under 538.215, we must reduce to present value the damages, and then we have to do it according to economic principle. Economic principle in this case resulted in reductions and a discount rate of up to 5%.
And let me stop. Oh, go ahead.
Yes.
Was that disputed at trial?
No. Okay. No dispute.
Well, and I think, I'm sure it wasn't disputed that was the appropriate long-term interest rate, but why opposing counsel suggests an answer to this dilemma can be that you don't discount by a standard long-term interest rate because that's based on what you assume someone will earn with the money they receive in the judgment over time. Here you know by statute they're going to receive a much more limited short-term interest rate. Therefore, your present value determination should be by a comparable short-term interest rate. But you chose not to do that. They say, therefore, you can't raise that here.
The practical problem with that is twofold. First of all, the reduction to present value statute does not specify a rate to reduce.
Exactly, but the other one does. So why aren't you free to vary that?
The practical problem of that is this. An economist will not reduce by an artificially low interest rate, and I've asked them about that. They won't do that.
And they'd be wrong, and this is just a practical issue. Certainly, in general, you don't use a short-term interest rate to reduce to present value. But if, in fact, by law, you're not allowed to have the normal reduction, the normal interest, then aren't you inaccurately saying what the present value of the money is if you use the standard long-term interest rate?
Well, that's the end result, that in it applying the short-term rate in the statute, which was recognized what happened in Watts, when the economic reduction to present value, that's exactly what happens. The problem is the expert is not going to reduce using an artificially low amount of money unless you can tell the expert that the court will instruct the jury that this is the statutory rate and instruct the jury that this is a statutory rate because it will be paid out over time.
And tell me why we can't do that. There may be many good reasons, but it would be helpful to
Well, the reason why is the statute doesn't allow it right now. And it's a practical problem that we deal with in a lot of legislation in day-to-day trial. For example, we have the statute that says in the death of minors you can use the wages of the parents. And so the economist will come in and do an assessment about the financial loss, the presumption under the statute. But then the court doesn't have direction as to whether or not they can advise the jury that there's a presumption under the law. Most judges don't allow the witness to say, I'm doing this because there's a presumption under the law. And so the expert gets cross-examined saying, well, why are you doing this? This has nothing to do with what the child would have earned. And so the practical problem is there's no direction that allows us to do that and allows us to then get an economist who will do that.
Even if you could do that, it's possible that interest rate would change from the date of the testimony to the date the judgment was entered. And so it would still be potentially, it may be off just a slight bit, but still might be off. Is that correct?
That's correct. We don't know what the spot rate will be on the date the judgment is entered at the time the expert does his evaluation. And so there would have to be a provision that the expert somehow be allowed to amend as to the spot rate on the date that it's done. And none of that is set up in place currently. And none of that is authorized by statute. And because of that, you end up with exactly what we had in Watts. And the similarities are very similar. We've got an interest rate that is much, much lower by the statute than the discount rate. Because of that, the plaintiff will not receive the money that the jury has awarded. Now, in Watts, the court said that it wasn't, the way I read it, since the court retained the ability to award in whole or in part, then the future payments was not going to be struck. But what the court did was exactly what occurred here. The judge in that case awarded half of the future medical damages to be put in future payments. That's what our judge did here. Both cases involve payouts over a long period of time, over 50 years. In both cases, the discount rate at trial and the discount rate in the statute were markedly different. In both cases, it would have resulted in and does result in a shortfall to the plaintiff. And in both cases, we would say if this is treated as Watts is treated, there would have to be a remand back to the court to make a new finding on what is fair and equitable to this plaintiff under these facts, given the interest rates that were used at trial.
Assume that that was done and that somebody was upset with that ruling and the case was appealed by one side or the other. What is the standard of review? Is it going to be abuse of discretion?
Yes.
And so then it would take a court of appeals or the Supreme Court to say that whatever the trial judge did is firmly against logic for it to be reversed.
That's correct.
Would 50-50 ever be firmly against logic?
Yeah, I think it's going to depend on the facts of the case and the amount at issue and what the disparity between the statutory rate and the trial rate is. So the court, Watts says the court has given the power to appraise the case, the evidence in the case that was presented, but it can't deprive the plaintiff of the money that they're entitled to, which happens when you use too low of a discount rate.
If Judge Fisher's
interest rate.
Judge Fisher's situation occurred, would you argue that, like in this case, where the present value wasn't disputed, would you argue that it's abuse of discretion to do anything that other than use the present value interest rate that was used during the trial?
I would certainly argue that. Because
the statute doesn't let you do.
Excuse me?
The statute doesn't let you pick that interest rate.
The statute does not allow you to pick that interest rate.
So is it an abuse of discretion to follow the statute?
If reading Watts, what they did, if you're asking me, when you have disparate interest rates, the same reasons that resulted in the cap for non-economics in Watts apply to the future damage computations. The plaintiff will not receive what the jury has awarded for future damages.
And it doesn't matter whether it's 50-50 or 99-1. If you put any money through the periodic payment under your analysis, the disparity in the interest rates means the plaintiff cannot recover what the jury gave him.
That's correct.
So you can make the problem smaller, but you can't make it go away if all you have left to argue about under the statute is how much is periodic and how much is lump.
Yes, in cases where there's such a disparity between the rates, there may be a time where the defense would be saying, well, the spot rate is much higher than a real discount rate by an economist. But as it currently stands, it is certainly unfair to the plaintiff because the disparity weighs against them.
Before you sit down, I know you're past time. Can you address, you're saying you're part of your attorney's fees were ordered to be also paid periodically in the future, and those should be paid currently?
No,
and how would that affect what we're talking about?
The other argument that we have is if the court is going to assess future payments, then the court needs to deduct attorney's fees from the amount of the future payments.
You have some attorney's fees that have not yet been paid. Is that right?
That's correct.
And they would be paid out of what?
Well, they would be paid, so for example,
without any changes, yeah.
Excuse me?
If the judgment remained as it is today, how would they be paid?
They would be paid out of the portion that is currently there for past damages and for pain and suffering. And so in this case, if the court were to affirm the $11 million granted for future payments, then we would ask that the attorney's fee be taken out of that so that the remainder be in future payments.
And how much of the $11 million would have to go to attorney's fees? I'm just wondering how this affects the future interest calculation, the future damage calculation.
I believe our fee's 40% on a trial.
So are you saying, and then there's no payments, or is yours? Or, and what happens to your payments if, say, the person were to die before they got all their
We would be recovery. Paid, and the statute provides for this, if there's a contingency fee, the attorney is to be paid up front.
Past damages are not enough to cover your attorney's fees, is that correct?
Past damages, in this case, past damages and the pain and suffering would cover the attorney's fees.
Okay.
Thank you. What you're asking is that the $11 million in future payments be reduced by the attorney's fees payable immediately, and then only the balance gets paid out over time.
If the court feels that $11 million is an appropriate exercise of discretion, that's correct. Thank you.
May it please the court? I'm sorry.
Whenever.
I don't want to get ahead of you. I have a handout of some things that might be of assistance. Although there are 1,001 things I want to say about the periodic payment issues, I think we have to go back to whether there's a judgment that even requires it, because in this case there needs to be a new trial. The integrity of a system of trial by jury is dependent upon a jury getting facts that have been narrowed by pretrial orders and agreements of attorneys, not surprise. It's also dependent on a proper instruction focusing the jury on what's important.
In regard to the instructional question, did you tender what you thought to be a proper instruction at trial?
No, it's not a duty upon a defendant to tender the instructions, although we made appropriate objections and preserve the issues.
You think that one objection applied to all the disjunctives?
Well, there are actually two or three objections, but the gist of the objections at the instruction conference was that it was a roving commission, it was unlimited in time, and the word adequate did not relate to causation. If you'll look at tab one, is the instruction. I want you to look at the instruction. And to take the instruction in context, this case is about a progressive disease. It's really a delayed chance of recovery, because the argument is that Dr. Pillipal did not refer soon enough or did not make an appropriate diagnosis soon enough. Mercy's defense was that by the time she presented, it was too late already, and it was the administration of a drug, trinitine, that 25% of the time makes the patient worse, not better, and that's what caused this problem. So timing is very important. I'm sorry, Judge Breckenridge.
Here you have a continuing course of treatment.
Yes.
And there are multiple events during that course of treatment that were alleged to be negligent.
Yes.
Do you have cases that have required there to be a identification of dates? Because you cite in your first brief, Lindquist, where merely the fact that they gave separate instructions showed there wasn't error, but that's not the same as saying you have to have several instructions. And Vest, the defendant was only responsible for one. So it seems as though, are there cases that say when there are a continuing course of treatment, the instructions must include a date where there were acts of negligence?
We don't have a case where that was addressed specifically by a court and where the court said you had to do it, although I think Lindquist sets a roadmap out for how it's proper to do it. And I would like you to look at page 2 in the instruction, the timeline. Here's the problem with the timeline. Plaintiff's evidence at trial. Now, plaintiff's evidence at trial shifted, but it ended with May of 2013 being the date at which plaintiff might have returned to normal had appropriate diagnosis and treatment been given. However, there was evidence of the doctor's visits, appointments, and emails subsequent to May in June and July. And this evidence is particularly troublesome because at the last appointment the doctor had, I believe that was June 28th, plaintiff indicated that she had fallen 5 times and her finger was extending. Then in July 23rd, plaintiff requests an MRI, although the MRI doesn't happen until August. Those are things the jury was allowed to look at in terms of negligence, was allowed to return a verdict on because there is no limitation in the instruction on time, but it was after the evidence of damage and causation gave any support at all.
You know, damage can continue over time, though, and so further damages occurred after May that might have been avoided. But I think what you're arguing is that if they found she was negligent in December and January, then everything that happened later would have been your client's fault. But if they found a regular doctor wouldn't have been negligent in not recognizing it from the symptoms shown then, but would have been when they saw her in May, the damages caused by that delay would have, only part of them would have been your
responsibility. That's great. The condition of the plaintiff changes over time. Now I'm not treating a patient who can be returned to normal. I don't have that a burden of damages. I'm treating a patient who, by their own expert's testimony, cannot return to normal.
And if you were negligent up front, then everything that happened later is still your fault, even if partly so.
Yes, that's right.
How would you submit what you're saying? You're saying the damages, would you have to have two separate instructions? One if you found them negligent early on and the other later?
Yeah, or? I understand the problem. I think that's a plaintiff's choice. Plaintiff could have said, given separate verdict or separate instructions for separate time periods all along, if you find that plaintiff was negligent on this date at this period. That's pretty much what happened in Lindquist. Here, they could have simply said, if you find that plaintiff was negligent on or before June 1st, but by allowing, by having no restriction at all, allowing the jury to rove through time all the way to August, the instruction allows a verdict that roves beyond where the plaintiff's causation and damage testimony ceases. And remember, Dr. Belts was the life care planner who said that this was, $17 million. The jury, in fact, gave 21, exceeded. They did not take into account any lessening of damage after May 21.
Well, are you suggesting that if the defendant had requested a limiting instruction on all that sort of evidence that the trial court would have been obligated to give it?
Well, I think the defendant made the appropriate injection. He says the jury instruction was given was not limited in any way to, I had it quoted. I don't have the objection just right here in front. Objection does not adequately focus the jury on the particular time period or particular visit of the alleged negligent acts and therefore are not sufficiently specific to be properly given as an instruction. The objection was precisely to this problem.
My concern is we've
never required defendants to draft plaintiffs' instructions.
I understand. My concern is that when you look at verdict directors in the disjunctive like this, I understand the problem that it creates. But are you concerned that the jury takes evidence concerning one of these allegations and applies it to the other, or you're just concerned that there's damage evidence that rubs off on negligence?
Well, first, there's so many problems with this instruction. The first problem is all subparts A, B, C, and D are not limited in time to damage and causation
except for if the jury applies the evidence to those disjunctives at one time, they themselves would sort that out.
No, But they can't sort out because Dr. Belts gave a life care plan that stopped in May. In May. And they are allowed to go all the way to August, all the time during which plaintiff's condition is changing.
You're saying Belts presumed negligence. You're saying Belts' plan presumed negligence as of May, but there was evidence they might have found you weren't negligent then, but you were negligent later, and it didn't fit.
Yes. Yeah, so time-wise, it doesn't work. Now, the other thing, I want to go back, Judge Fischer, because you're exactly right. If you look at subparts A and B, now, this case, I would suggest, this case really is a subpart C and D case. It's was she correctly diagnosed? Was she timely referred? But there are two, A and B, and their objections to these two, failed to take an adequate history in regards to Emily Williams' tremor or failed to adequately consider Emily Williams' medical chart. When? What time? What chart? What's adequately consider? What's adequately take a history? This instruction allowed the jury to rove through the evidence and come back without reference to specific acts of negligence. A lot of times we sweep this under the rug and say the jury can fix it. But the jury, this is just roving so much. But,
well, that objection below was not that specific, though. It just said roving commission really with time. You didn't address chart with
yes,
the
there
chart
is chart. Chart specifically spoken about. Just a second, I can.
I don't want to take your time with that. It's okay. Judge Powell had a question, I believe.
Okay, it's in the brief. It's in the brief that exactly what he said in the instruction conference. The instruction conference is pretty short. It's at 1627 in the transcript, yes. And
did you offer any converse instructions?
No.
Not on any point.
I don't believe so. I don't believe there was a converse.
Your opponent argues that such evidentiary matters are left to arguments. You know, such details as to time and other evidentiary matters are left to argument.
Instructions are the court's. Argument are the attorney's. We have always said what you say in argument doesn't matter in terms of error because it's just argument. How can argument correct instructions?
But it doesn't necessarily correct it, but isn't that go to whether there was prejudice here by any claim of error to the instruction? Because it wasn't argued that way.
However, the evidence wasn't argued. You have just told the jury, here's a permissible verdict. Here's a permissible verdict when it's not supported by the evidence, when it roves throughout. No, instructions are the job of the court. If you say instructions don't matter, plaintiff's final argument is all that matters. What have you just done to the law? I mean, that would set Missouri trial law upside down forever.
Well, let's take A, for example. Let's talk about A.
Yes.
Failed to take an adequate history. When I read the record, all of that history was talking about the initial meeting and the discussion about how somebody of this age, if they would have had tremors, X, Y, and B. I mean, the jury surely isn't looking at those dates down there when they're applying it to A.
How do you know? The instruction doesn't prevent them from doing it. When you look at an instruction, you look at what does it allow the jury to do. And here we have disjunctive instruction, unlimited in time or event. It allows the jury to do that. You cannot presume the jury read this instruction one way or another. You have to take the instruction as it is. Now, I want to quickly go to another issue, and that's the jump in testimony by Dr. Bells and Dr. Fisher to talk for the first time about subacute necrosis in the trial. Now, there was a pretrial order. Here, there was a pretrial order, and the pretrial order said, as to defense's matters, the motion was to prevent any expert witness from testifying to any fact or opinion that was not expressed by the witness during deposition. The order by the judge says sustained by agreement. So experts by pretrial order aren't to testify other than what they said in their depositions. Dr. Belts said in his deposition, his scope was to present, the question was, My understanding is that the scope of your retention is to perform what's called a life care plan. Is that correct? That's correct. A life care plan, also known as a preventative medicine plan. Mr. Rahmeyer then said, I think he's going to talk about bills, but he hasn't calculated them yet. That's what he's going to talk about. All of a sudden at trial, he starts talking about subacute necrosis. And what that means is when cells die. And he said in an August MRI, we subacute necrosis for the first time, that's when the MRI was, and it goes back to May. That's when everything happened. Now that substantially changed the nature of the case, because Dr. Fisher then comes in and says, because of that, we know that this drug, trinitine, did not worsen her condition. She had it as of May. There's two things that are important. It shifts the time, and it sticks May as a date for causation and damages. That goes back to the instruction. But it also then says trinitine isn't the real problem. Mercy's defense was trinitine was the real problem. In this case, her condition worsened until August 9th, but when she was given that drug, it cratered. And it cratered bad.
Expert saying this until Belts?
Well, subacute necrosis, the first time it comes up is at trial. It's in neither of the depositions, and they jump the depositions. Now, I know this court generally says, well, that's just trial court discretion. There's no problem. Let the expert say what the expert wants. But here, you have a major shift in focus. It changed the evidence, changed the trial. Was directly against the pretrial order.
Am I correct that the court let you do a rebuttal expert for that reason?
The court did, although it wasn't adequate. It doesn't, the expert couldn't come back. He had to come back through an electronic link. And two, this was such a major change, that wasn't a complete remedy. Now, I haven't answered any questions
I have a question for you about have you had an opportunity to review the Holly versus Pilot case?
Pardon?
The prejudgment, the case that came out in August, where both the majority and the concurring opinion said that the court lacked authority outside the 30 days to modify or grant a new trial on any basis that wasn't included in the motion.
Yeah,
and it's important as it relates to this case as to post-judgment interest.
I don't think that applies here. 7808. Says plain error review can be raised at any time, whether it's in or out. It's a court rule. Mm-hmm. We could be here talking to you today about plain error and asking you to correct this had Judge Powell not done so. And you should have, because the statute precludes it. Twice, plaintiff submits two judgment forms to the court that includes post-judgment interest and does not tell the court that it's directly against statute. It is required by our ethical rules that when you ask a court to do something where there's clear authority to the contrary, you must bring it to the court. Plaintiffs cannot profit by their own failure to abide by professional rules. Secondly, the second big reason that doesn't apply is 7807. The judge did change the order, or changed the judgment. He changed it in accordance with properly preserved post-trial motion.
But he had no authority to do that
interest.
Under our rule.
No, he
we
had,
may have
no,
authority
no, to do the periodic payments, he
oh,
had she, authority to
yeah,
do
yeah,
it.
No, I mean the
and once he does
interest.
That, that's a new judgment for all purposes. 7807, that's what the rule says.
But that only gives him
and
30
if it,
days.
And if it's a new judgment for all purposes, everything's open right. all over
well,
again.
Well, for 30 days. For
yeah,
30
and,
days.
And then, he and changed then, it, so there's nothing we need to go in and ask him to change again. It would be, why are we supposed to go and say, Judge, you entered a new order. It corrected our problem. Mm-hmm. Now I'm supposed to go to him and say, would you re-correct what you've already corrected?
Well, that's my question about plain error is, the first step of plain error is whether it's open, obvious, and clear. And I guess my concern is, regardless of who submits the judgment, you submit one, they submit one, the judge signs it, it's the judge's judgment. just like these instructions.
That's right, but this is a judgment that's contrary to statute, and you know what the professional rule says.
Right. No, I understand. My concern is that what do we do when nobody caught it? I'm not imputing bad motive to Mr. Garner or whoever tried this case. Just a second.
I'm sorry.
I think you and I both think the statute is crystal clear, right? But is that the same to say that every time a judge doesn't follow a statute that constitutes plain error? Because we're going to get lots of it if that's what the rule is.
I'm afraid to say it is plain error, and it can be corrected when it needs to be corrected, specifically in this amount. This isn't a judgment for $2 or $3 million. This is a judgment for 28.911. This is a judgment where periodic payments are to extend for $21 million. That's huge. And the statute says the plaintiff needs that money for the rest of her life and to make sure it's there. I want to talk just one little second about attorney's fees. You go back and read the statute. It doesn't say in there that attorney fees are to be paid. It says it's presumed that they'll be paid. And it really says attorney's fees are a matter between the plaintiff and her attorneys.
No, it says if they choose to do it periodically, then it's between them.
I don't think you can apply with constitutional significance a plaintiff and her attorney's agreements to a party who doesn't agree or to the court. No. If you do, that brings us right into their business of their attorney's fees. And I just think, you know, the plaintiff in the hearing on periodic payments said that the attorney's fee were the 300-pound gorilla in the room. That was out of their mouths, not mine. Whatever they do on that side, unless you really want to get into it, should not be applied regarding periodic payments. And the statute itself says that the attorney's fee should not be subject to the terms of periodic payments.
Let me, first of all, the only thing worse than trying a medical malpractice case in Greene County is trying it twice. So suffice it to say, we went through these instructions frontwards, backwards. We went through that book. We went through the cases. These were the instructions that we felt fit the evidence and the argument that was going to be presented. They say you can't rely upon argument. Well, that's simply not what the MAI book says, and it's not what Stone versus Duffy says, and a number of other cases that say when you're judging whether or not an instruction gives a roving commission, you have to look at it in conjunction with the evidence and with the argument of counsel. In this case, the evidence was that her condition was reversible, as they say, through May. There's only three visits, and in each of those three visits, the expert said the same things had occurred. The same violations had occurred, and that's what resulted in her continued denial of sending them to a neurologist. Three visits, and when I argued the case, I specifically told them the negligence, if you look at the argument, May 31st, that's the cutoff. Now, when you read the opinions that talk about looking at argument, it says the courts to assume you've got jurors of average intelligence that have followed the evidence. Our experts discussed three visits where there were breaches of the standard of care. There were three visits that were causative, according to our causation experts, and it was argued properly to the jury. And when you look at some of the other cases that have dealt with this, the Blount versus Floor case, in that case, it was a case written by Judge Moody, and the Smelters were arguing that they should have had an instruction saying they were only liable for their partnership time. And Judge Moody said, why would I assume that is error when I look at the argument of the plaintiff? They did not ask for anything beyond their partnership time. And I look at the argument of the defendant, and they specifically told them what the time was, and it was when they were partnership. And so the instructions, when you go through, there was no obstruction that A was ambiguous, that adequate was ambiguous, no objection to B other than it didn't wasn't supported by the evidence, and then they're not saying anything about the other two subparts. The time element was taken care of by the evidence and the argument. I do want to address real quickly these claims about surprise, and I first want to deal with Dr. Bell's. And Grant, if you could grab those things, because this is kind of an issue that keeps popping up when an expert doesn't use the exact same language that they used in their deposition. First of all, subacute necrosis was not stated as an opinion. Dr. Bell's was asked to read an MRI that was in evidence and the words in the MRI and explain what the words meant. He was asked for a medical definition, okay? That's number one. He didn't voice an opinion about the MRI. He simply read it. Now, when you read Dr. Bell's testimony, this is a witness that was on the stand for about 2.5 or 3 hours. There are two objections in Dr. Bell's, and I can give you the pages. The one page is, there are two objections that are pretty close together in a 3.5 hour witness. The first objection was withdrawn and overruled, and it was, who made the entry of acute necrosis in that record? Was it you? Because we want to make sure the jury knew he wasn't voicing that opinion. It was the opinion of the radiologist who read it. They withdrew that objection. The only other objection to Dr. Bell's was sustained and no further relief was asked. So generally, if you come into court and you've made two objections, one of which was withdrawn and the other is sustained, and you ask for no more relief, you don't get accused of doing things improperly. The other thing I wanted to bring out is that when we were discussing the issue of him using the MRI, after Dr. Fruck testified out of turn and discussed the 2017 MRI, I told Randy Coward that Bell's is going to put the MRI into evidence. He's the one that ordered it, and his testimony is going to be limited to the fact that he agrees with the reading of the radiologist that there's not a change from August of 2013 to February 2017. And so in the conference on this, Mr. Coward said, what I got from you, and he was talking to me, was he's reviewed it, he sees no changes. That's what I was told. Yes, that's what I had told him. And he said, now if he goes beyond that, yeah, I'm going to have a problem, because that's what I was told. And that's what he was told. Now, the next is the court's ruling, where he grants exactly what Mr. Coward had asked for, and which I told him was going to happen, which was he was going to say that there was no change between the two MRIs. That's what he did say. There's no objection otherwise anywhere in his testimony that he went beyond what I was ordered to do. Now, when you get to Dr. Fisher and the claims of change, you've got to take into account Dr. Fisher was allowed to rebut the testimony of Dr. Frucht. So Dr. Frucht in this case, Fisher obviously was deposed before Frucht. Dr. Frucht was deposed. And in his deposition, he accused and said all the injuries were due to Triantine and all the injuries were due to malpractice of the people in Michigan. So we named a rebuttal expert. They opposed it. The court said, I'm not going to give you a rebuttal expert, but Dr. Fisher can rebut what Dr. Frucht says. Okay? So obviously, if he's going to rebut a witness who was deposed after his deposition, he's going to have new information. They never asked for a deposition. The only thing that they're complaining about in Dr. Fisher's testimony is the fact that after he reviewed Dr. Scari's deposition, Dr. Lorenz's deposition, and the 2017 MRI, he said that it cast into question my opinion about whether Triantine had caused a decline. His two opinions were, number one, that, first of all, if this had been diagnosed earlier and treated, she would not have had any issues. And secondly, if she was diagnosed early, Triantine would not have caused a reaction. Those two opinions that he voiced in his deposition remained his opinions at trial. The only minor deviation was what I just said, and he was cross-examined about that, and that's what Judge Powell said. Well, you can cross-examine him about that change of opinion. If you accept their definition of surprise, anytime a witness, an expert, is impeached with prior testimony, that would count as surprise. And it just, things just don't work that way in my experience. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, counsel.